And we're ready for the next case to be called.
Calling case number 824-0305, Eugene Purpose v. State of Minnesota.
And counsel, go ahead and set up. You're familiar with the court proceedings. Please remember to state who you are and who you're speaking on behalf of before beginning your argument. And I don't want to rush you. Whenever you're ready, appellant counsel, you can approach the podium. There is a switch on the underside of the podium. You can go up or down depending on your height preference.
I think I might have to go down with this one.
The two gentlemen before me had significant height advantages, I think. Good thing we're not playing basketball. May it please the court, counsel, Mr. Eugene Kuipers. My name is Bo McGraw. I represent the appellant in these proceedings. We are here on a denial of a post-conviction relief petition filed in Washington County District Court before the Honorable Judge Freeman, which was denied on January 25 of 2024. The petition sought relief relative to a conviction that dated back to 2001. Specifically, my client entered a plea of guilty to a charge of second-degree unintentional murder. He was sentenced to 130 months, which was to be served consecutive to a sentence for a 1990 conviction relative to first-degree murder and burglary. The crux of his petition and the crux of this appeal is what happened at that plea hearing.
Well, I think we kind of understand what happened at the plea hearing, but my question is, how do you meet the second prong of showing that things would have been different if he had gone to trial? I mean, you got to show that he would have prevailed in some way, or he would not have pled guilty. The problem is that we don't have a record of what happened in the second murder of the prison official. Whether he would have been convicted of the first degree charge.
We don't know that, and because of that, we're left to speculate. But I think what the law does is it puts us back in the position that said if he has the information available to him that he should have had, if his attorney would have provided him with the relevant information about what the consequences of his plea would have been, then he would have been in the position, we would have been in the position to know what that other side would have looked like. We know at the time that he entered this plea that he was of the belief, the court was of the belief, importantly, Judge Miles, opposing counsel was of the belief that this negotiation as it relates to time really wasn't all that relevant. It was almost like they were playing with funny money time that would have never been realized. My client, when he sat before the court in front of Judge Miles at the time that he entered that plea, he thought that he would not be released until 2086, I believe. The prosecution was asked when they thought he would be released, and I think they said 2088 or something to that respect.
All sorts of dates that were stated, 2088, 2091, but that doesn't have a bearing on what your argument is.
I think it does, Your Honor, with all due respect. I think it absolutely does. Because if our goal is for folks to come before the court and enter pleas having all the relevant information in front of them, so those pleas can be intelligent and they can waive those most fundamental rights to trial, we need the relevant facts. And for an individual that sits before the court where
the finality, the date, I mean, in terms of even today as far as sentencing, you don't tell someone when they're going to be out. You'll give a number of years, but the computation of that is not a function. It's not a function of the plea hearing.
I think that's true. I would agree with that. But I think that discussion can be a bit nuanced if we're allowed to have it today. I think if we're talking about, you know, a matter of months, maybe we're talking about a year, maybe a couple years, but when you have someone that's sitting before the court that's making a decision to enter a plea and take a sentence that is sizable, 130 months, and they don't think they're ever going to see the light of day, they think they're going to die in prison. The court seems to confirm that he was right in that belief, that he would never see the light of day. His own attorney seemed to believe that, and the prosecution as well. So we're talking about an individual that, if this would have gone different, if he would have received a concurrent sentence, we'd be talking about a release.
Okay, well, so we're talking about the merits. What about the time bar? Is that your biggest obstacle for this court, your time bar?
I think it is. I think this is a really good case. I think it's reversible error if we're back in 2002 or 2003. I think clearly we are. I don't know. I wish we were back there. I don't have a time machine. We're not back there. But here we are. And the beautiful part about our system of justice is that reviewing courts such as this has the ability to do what is right and correct an injustice at any point. And what the law says here, that if there's a manifest injustice that's going to occur as a result of this plea, meaning it wasn't intelligently entered, meaning he had already been sentenced, this court has the ability to rectify that manifest injustice.
Well, isn't the claim, though, still governed by the post-conviction statute, which includes time frames during which such claims have to be asserted?
It is, and we're looking for an exception in that regard. We're looking for the exception of the interest of justice exception that a lot of folks come before this court asking this court to award relief based upon that. And when I look at those five factors, my first thought was, and I said this to counsel when we were in the conference room prior to coming in here, I didn't want to foreshadow my argument too much, but it dawned upon me that I do a fair bit of trial work, and when I look at these five factors, the first one is whether the claim has substantive merit. Well, I don't think there's any doubt the claim has substantive merit. I'll let this court make a good sound decision on that, but I have no doubt that it does, because if we put ourselves back in 2002 or 2003, we would all have to agree that this is the kind of case where he would be allowed to withdraw his plea. So, absent the time, looking strictly at the merits of the claim, if we go back at that time, this case, his plea is withdrawn every single time. So we can only conclude that it has merit. Number two, whether the defendant deliberately and inexcusably failed to raise the issue on direct appeal. How do we make that determination here? Why didn't the district court put this matter on for a hearing where there could be factual findings, testimony that was taken?
But counsel, do we even get to this, what I'll call the Gassler five-factor analysis, if the claimed interest of justice, if you're aware of the claim and don't bring it within that two-year period of time? I mean, I understand talking about he didn't understand it between 2001 and 2021, or am I got the dates? I have the dates right.
I think you're really close, Your Honor.
Right, 2021. But we know that in the brief that was filed on his behalf in April of 2021. In fact, he pointed out, you know what? We all thought I was going to be until 2089, and that wasn't true. So isn't he aware of his claim right then and doesn't bring it within the next 2 years? Isn't that the dispositive question, not before we would even get to Gassler?
I still think we can get to Gassler. I think this court can make that consideration, and you can deny his appeal based upon that potentially. I would ask that you don't do that. I would ask that we take a deeper look, and there's a lot of reasons why folks are not able to come forward with claims. First of all, once we get past a direct appeal standpoint, it requires folks to have resources to hire lawyers. You're looking at somebody that was in prison, in an incarcerated setting, since roughly 1990. The idea that this individual has excess money laying around to hire lawyers to come in and make these type of arguments, they just don't. So once folks, sometimes it takes people to come into their lives to assist them with these matters. And if there would have been testimony taken in this case, we would have found out that to be true. And when that happened, then this individual had the ability to assert these claims. And I don't even know then, if we're using that as the start time, and then 2 years after that, who's to say that this court wouldn't have said your start time was back in 2001? Probably would have said that. So we come to the same place. And we come to the same place, do we want a system of justice that allows us to get to the right place, or do we want to weave through all these procedural rules that are designed to not allow folks access to the courtroom? Also, it provides certainty, I get that. But our entire criminal justice system is focused on the rights of the defendant. So I think we have to get to the five factors, and I think we have to look at those. And if we start looking at those factors, I'm concerned as to how this court has the ability to make decisions based on those factors when we don't have any factual findings. This court, I'm aware of very few ineffective assistance of counsel claims where we don't have a hearing set. I think Judge Freeman in this case said that a hearing was never requested. I would ask that the court look back at the petition, and the petition makes clear that an attorney, a hearing was requested. And if a hearing was requested, it should have either been granted or not granted in some respect, but to say that a hearing hasn't been requested so the court's going to move forward with an analysis seems to me to not be proper, because this court now is having to make factual findings where we don't have a record for it, specifically whether defendant deliberately and inexcusably failed to raise the issue on direct appeal. I don't know how we get to an answer on that unless we start taking testimony. There's witnesses that could have provided that, could have tracked down his former attorney that handled that appeal. We could have had him provide testimony as well. We then have appropriate factual findings that a reviewing court such as this then can look at that testimony and determine whether or not it fits the law. The next item, I would submit to this court, though, that that testimony would allow the district court to conclude that he did not deliberately, inexcusably fail to raise the issue on direct appeal. The next part of our analysis is a third prong, whether the party alleging error is at fault for that error, and the degree of fault assigned to the party, including defending the alleged error. So we're not only talking fault now, we're talking degree of fault. How do we get there if we don't take testimony? I would submit to this court that if that testimony would have been taken, if there would have been a hearing that would have been granted, my client, too, would have satisfied that prong. The next one is number four, whether some fundamental unfairness to the defendant needs to be addressed. He would have satisfied that prong. We have no testimony in that regard. And then I think the last one is the most significant one, and I think it fits most into the case of Mr. Eugene Kuypers. Whether application of the interests of justice analysis is necessary to protect the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of judicial proceedings. Gassler v. State. My client was a co-defendant in this case. The individual that was the other co-defendant was serving a very similar sentence as my client, meaning he was serving time for a first-degree premeditated murder offense. The defendant, this other defendant, after my client had pled guilty, received a concurrent sentence. Not a consecutive sentence.
Of the prior appeal, correct? That was an unfair sentence because it was disparate to the co-defendant's sentence.
Correct.
Right.
And if we're trying to have some measure of fairness and some measure of justice, the idea that this individual would receive a concurrent sentence, and I would even submit to this court that the facts in that case, if we're going to dig into it, would suggest that that co-defendant was much more blameworthy in the murder than my client. If we look at their sentences, they are distinctly different. And they're different in that one was a concurrent and one was a consecutive sentence, and that individual will be released from prison much sooner than my client. I would also leave the court with this. If we look at that transcript on the plea, not only do we have this massive confusion about whether or not he is even subject to a release or a parole, but we almost have this afterthought thrown in where his defendant, his attorney, my client's attorney, on the record, talks about the agreement. And he's silent as to how the 130 months is going to be served, whether it's going to be consecutive or concurrent.
And it's not in the written plea agreement. I mean, the plea petition, right.
Thank you, Your Honor. And it's not in the written plea petition.
But your client was aware of that at the time. And went forward with the plea.
He was. So then Mr. Thole, the prosecutor at that time, and says, Your Honor, just so we're clear, it's going to be a consecutive sentence, not a concurrent second sentence. We don't know if my client had discussions with his attorney about whether or not it was consecutive versus concurrent, whether or not he fully grasped those concepts. Not everybody does. He had been down for about 10 years, so those people have some more familiarity. But there's nothing on the record that suggests that that was a negotiated term prior to getting in front of the court. And to get to Your Honor's question exactly, did my client understand that that was a term of the plea? We have to conclude he did based upon what was on the record, right? We don't know what that meant. But most importantly to that issue, the information that he needed to properly determine whether or not that was a reasonable way to resolve a very, very serious felony case was missing, namely whether or not he would ever see the light of day again, or was he negotiating with fake time? And in this case, the facts support that conclusion that he was, and there's all kinds of timing requirements that have been missed along the way. But we don't allow people to sit in prison when they shouldn't be, when we've been when time has been missed along the way. We need to get to the right spot, and it's a matter of justice. Absent questions, I'll sit down and patiently listen to counsel's argument. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, and may it please the court, counsel. My name is Andrew Jackala. I'm with the Washington County Attorney's Office, and I'm here on behalf of the state of Minnesota. Counsel seems to encourage this court to exercise its powers to act in the interest of justice. While this court may enjoy some of those powers, this court also needs to be respectful of the separation of powers. And with respect to the time limits here that counsel is asking the court to brush aside and give no heed to, the legislature has spoken. The legislature has spoken a number of times on this. What we had is, at the time of the conviction, there was a post-conviction statute that did not have a clear timeline for when post-conviction petitions must be brought. After the conviction, in this case, the legislature spoke again in 2005 and said, we are going to impose a 2-year time limit on petitions for post-conviction relief. And for all the people who have not brought their post-conviction petitions, we're giving you a 2-year period here. People who have convictions that predate the earlier statute, we're giving you 2 years to do that. And not only that, but under special circumstances, somebody can even bring a claim, a petition for post-conviction relief after that 2-year period has expired, if the interests of justice so require.
This case seems to cry out to be one of those cases. I mean, it seems like the record's clear that in 2001, when he entered this plea, it didn't matter. I mean, people didn't understand that the distinction between a concurrent and a consecutive sentence would matter at all. That turned out to not be the case. Why isn't this precisely the kind of case that the district court should consider on its merits in the interest of justice?
Well, I think for a couple of reasons, Your Honor. First of all, as this court noted in the prior decision on this case, what we have here in both Mr. Kuiper's case and his co-defendant, Mr. Guyton, were negotiated plea agreements. So both of the defendants came forward, worked with the prosecution, and negotiated what they deemed to be their own, the best resolution that they could accept given the facts and circumstances of the case. We don't have a full record of what those facts and circumstances were. We have allegations that were made in the underlying criminal complaint, but we don't have a thoroughly developed record because Mr. Kuiper's elected to negotiate a plea rather than going forward with the trial. So to the extent that we're missing some of that information, it's due to the circumstances of this case and the fact that he brought about this outcome through negotiating his own fate. So it's difficult to look at the two cases, compare them. The Court of Appeals previously said you can't even do that because there are circumstances relevant to each case that go beyond the fact that they're both convicted murderers who are now standing trial again for committing a murder inside prison.
Even if we agree with you that because they're negotiated pleas, that prevents a court from simply modifying a sentence, what about the ineffective assistance of counsel component?
Well,
I wouldn't have pled guilty if I had known this was going to be consecutive and that would make a difference. And I've been here so long and I don't want to stay another 130 years after my murder sentences, after I'm eligible for supervised release on that.
Well, and I understand that, and who would want to do extra time? But let's not forget the fact that this man is a 2-time convicted murderer. If we're looking at the ineffective assistance claim, looking at the Strickland standard, What we're talking about here, release on supervised release or parole, like in the Bell case, there's clear case law that that is not a direct consequence of a guilty plea, of a plea. It's a collateral consequence. And that stands to reason because at the time a plea is entered, we can't forecast what's going to happen in the future. There are a wide host of factors that our review panel would consider in determining whether or not to release somebody from prison, either on parole or supervised release. So there's just too many variables at the time of the plea to go too far down that analysis because it's uncertain. It's inherently uncertain just by the nature of there being the potential, not a guarantee, potential for either parole or supervised release. So under case law, this isn't something that defense counsel has an obligation to advise the client about because it is a collateral consequence. Therefore, we can't show prejudice under the under that prong of the Strickland test. But getting back to my separation of powers argument, and Judge Bjorkman, you raised this when counsel was up here, that the legislature did speak and say that even if we have a claim that cries out for justice, not frivolous, in the interest of justice, there is still a 2-year time period. From the time that the claim arises, that's when the petitioner has to bring the claim. That's what the legislature has told us, and this court's inherent powers to act within the interest of justice are limited by that provision in the statute.
So do we get to Gassler at all if we agree with you that this was not timely within the 2 years for interest of justice exception?
No, no, Your Honor, we absolutely don't. The time question, the timeliness question, is absolutely dispositive of this case. And we do have a unique record here because we can look with precision and find out when the claim arises. A claim arises, this court says, when a defendant knows or has reason to know about a claim that could give rise to a petition for post-conviction relief. And in a previous case before this court, the 2021 case, counsel for Mr. Kuipers wrote, it's on page 12 of his brief, because Kuipers received a consecutive sentence, he cannot begin to serve his 130 months until he is granted supervised release after 30 years on his 1990 conviction. So counsel is saying in that brief that we recognize at this point in time, April 6th, 2021, that Mr. Kuipers was eligible for supervised release 30 years after his conviction. The date is important. April 6th, 2021. Looking at the statute, subdivision 4C, says 2 years from the date the claim arises. We know that April 6, 2021, he had knowledge of his claim. This petition for post-conviction relief, the second one, was not brought until May 10, 2023. You do the math, it's outside the 2-year time limit. Case closed. That issue is absolutely dispositive. And I think that issue also, if the court does make its way to the Gassler factors, I think that issue does speak to a couple of those issues as well. The second factor, does the defendant inexcusably fail to bring the claim on time? Yeah, he did. He had knowledge back at least as early as April 2021 and didn't bring the claim until May 2023, outside the 2-year period. Protect the fairness and integrity of the justice system. Justice system can only operate with rules, and some of those rules are handed down by the legislature. So to the extent that this court might feel as though there's an interest of justice exception, you have to turn to the statute and say, this is what the legislature has given us. We might find there are some sympathies for Mr. Kuipers in this case due to the circumstances of how this proceeded, but our hands are tied by the legislature. We have 2 years from the date that the claim arose, and he did not meet that timeline. Just in closing, I see I have a few minutes left. I'm certainly willing to stand for any questions, but I would just point this court to the Bell decision, which I think is very much on point. That case, of course, dealt with a parole eligibility rather than a supervised release eligibility. But from the state's perspective, the two cases are very much in line, and the distinction between those two forms of release are not relevant to the ultimate conclusion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You have the last word?
I would rest based upon my previous argument, my written submissions, unless the court has any further inquiry.
It appears not. Thank you both for appearing today in support of your arguments. The matters are submitted. A decision will be issued within the statutory 90-day timeframe. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.